I'm late. I had to stop by the Wax Museum again and give the finger to FDR.
We know Al-Qaeda, Zawahiri, is supporting the opposition in Syria. Are we supporting Al-Qaeda in Syria?
Well, it's a proud day for America. And by God, we've kicked Vietnam Syndrome once and for all. Thank you very, very much.
I say it again, you've been had. You've been took. You've been hoodwinked.
These witnesses are trying to simply deny things that just about everybody else accepts as fact.
He came, he saw, he died.
Well, we ain't killing their army, but we killing them. We be on CNN like, say our name, Ben, say it three times.
The meeting of the largest armies in the history of the world. Then there's going to be an invasion.
All right, you guys, on the line, I've got Trevor Aronson from The Intercept and author of the great book, The Terror Factory, which, of course, is a reference to the FBI. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Trevor?
Good, Scott. Thanks for having me.
So happy to talk to you again. And on such an important and positive occasion, Hamid Hayat from the big fake Lodi, California terrorism case of, I think, 2005 has finally been freed from prison. Do tell.
Yeah, after nearly 15 years in prison, Hamid Hayat was released after a U.S. magistrate judge held an evidentiary hearing, realized that the case was highly problematic and recommended its overturning, which ultimately the presiding judge 7 months later agreed to, and Hayat was released earlier this month. And it's a huge thing in the sense that, you know, we've had more than 800 defendants convicted on international terrorism-related charges since 9/11. A lot of these cases were quite problematic, and Hayat is really the first that we've seen where we have a full overturning and he's ultimately released. And, you know, I think it's worth noting, as I did in the story, that, you know, much of this probably wouldn't have happened were it not for the fact that, you know, media organizations, you know, spent 15 years questioning and finding more and more about this case that was problematic. And in the end, the evidence that the magistrate judge used in recommending its overturning, you know, wouldn't have been possible in all likelihood were it not for this kind of media scrutiny. You know, so it's certainly a travesty of justice that this guy spends nearly 15 years in prison. But, you know, at least, the small comfort is that, you know, justice was served, even if it took a very long time.
Yeah. Well, and let that be a lesson to young people in the audience, too, that if people don't do the work doesn't get done. As simple as that. People like Trevor and people at the ACLU and writers for the LA Times and other people who have been interested in this and decided for their own reasons to make this their issue. As you say, they're the ones who made this happen. Not a matter of sharing the credit for boasting purposes or whatever, but in, you know, to show that it actually takes people getting up in the morning and making sure that they're going to do their part to free this guy, or else it just doesn't happen. He's still sitting in the cell.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think so many of these terrorism prosecutions after 9/11 and the kind of zeal to find, you know, the so-called sleeper cells after 9/11, you know, were hugely problematic and quite abusive. You know, in Hyatt's case, you know, they found this informant who was working at a fast food restaurant, you know, making $7 an hour. And over the next couple of years, they paid him nearly $300,000. And he's the one that ultimately told the FBI that Hayat was involved in terrorism. They had no evidence to support that. And then ultimately what the FBI did was they interrogated him until 3 o'clock in the morning. And he's complaining that his head hurts. And they kept telling him, hey, we know you went to this training camp. We know you went to this training camp. And he finally just, you know, told them whatever he needed to tell them just to get out of that room, you know, not realizing that he was kind of built, you know, digging his own grave. And, you know, ultimately he was convicted on that really problematic and coerced confession. And, you know, what came out in the evidentiary hearing and what came out ultimately through the reporting on this case was that, you know, witnesses were found in Pakistan who basically said, yeah, he was in Pakistan, but, you know, he just played video games and soccer the whole time. We saw him every day. There's no way he went to a training camp. And, you know, even in the confession he gave the FBI, he couldn't even really say where the camp was. At one point he said it was in Afghanistan. Another time he said it was in Pakistan. During the trial, the government, you know, went so far as to show satellite images that said, hey, here's the camp he went to. But then it turned out there was an internal memo inside the government where they were talking about how the intelligence analysts couldn't agree on which camp he went to. So, you know, the prosecutors knew there was no consensus about what camp he went to, and yet they still presented to the jury as if there was, and you know, ultimately that's, you know, how he was convicted. And it's really shameful. It took, you know, 14 years in prison for him to, you know, finally get free. Mm-hmm.
And now I guess someone mentioned in the Reddit room that his case is highlighted in a new Netflix documentary series. Is that right?
If it is, I wasn't familiar with this. Actually, that would be news to me. I'd be interested to hear more about that.
So it's something called The Confession Tapes. It's a whole series about bad confessions, and apparently his is one of them.
Oh, okay. I have heard of this show. I didn't realize Hyatt's case was in that. That's really interesting. I'll have to look that up. Yeah.
I haven't seen it, but...
I guess in that vein, too, that, you know, what they might also talk about his father's confession, too, because there are really two confessions. Hamid Hyatt gave one, and at the same time Hyatt was giving one, they took his father into an interrogation room and basically were like, you know, hey, your son, he confessed attending this training camp. You know, we know you probably visited him. And at first he was saying, no, I didn't visit any training camp. And then they said to him, well, you know, if you went to visit this camp, it wouldn't really be much different than like a, you know, a parent in the United States doing a college campus visit for their child. And at that point, Umar, his father, you know, told him this fanciful story where, you know, there were like 1,000 terrorists or jihadis dressed in masks, like Ninja Turtles was his term, and that they were attacking with swords these dummies that were made to look like George W. Bush and Colin Powell and Rumsfeld. And, you know, of course, immediately after he recanted and, you know, said kind of rather tellingly that, you know, he based his descriptions on the movie The Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles, which he'd watched recently. And it was clear from his confession that he was basing it on this ridiculous movie. And so both of those confessions were ultimately kind of coerced by the government, you know, in large part because Hamid and his father weren't particularly savvy, you know, weren't particularly sophisticated about the criminal process. And the FBI agents were really going into these kind of interrogations, firmly believing that these guys were involved in terrorism when, in fact, they weren't at all.
Mm-hmm. Well, okay, so I don't want to overstate this or whatever, but it's really one continuum kind of a thing here, I think. And it's the proof that with so many of these false confessions, that torture does work. And this is very light, no touch torture, don't get me wrong, but a couple of big fat stinky cops in a small room with a bright hot light for hours and hours and hours demanding that you just admit this or just admit that, and then with a bunch of promises that then we'll let you go, then you can go home, then you can see your mom, then you can have a drink of water, then everything will be okay again. It's really just out of 1984, where O'Brien is Winston Smith's torturer, but he also administers the dose of morphine and says, see, I'm your big brother, I love you, I'm taking care of you, I'm good cop and bad cop at the same time. And what they do is they just shorten people's time preference down to never mind what happens in court later and whether I'm facing 35 years or whatever it is. I want out of this room right now, and I'm willing to say whatever they want me to say to get out of this room right now. They promised me a cold Sprite.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's what happened in Hamid's case. And that's what happens in a lot of cases. I mean, that's why I always tell my friends and, you know, I tell my wife and my daughter, like, you know, even if you get pulled over by the cops, you know, for a traffic violation, you know, don't volunteer anything, you know, just, you know, tell them what they need to know, you know. And I think, like, you know, even if you didn't get involved in a crime, that there's no upside to allowing a cop to kind of grill you and interrogate you and ask you these questions. I mean, you know, the first thing Hamid should have said, and it probably would have prevented his prosecution, was, you know, find me a lawyer, please. I'm not talking, right? And, you know, they could have him wait there all he wants, but they're not going to grill him and, you know, keep him up till 3 a.m. with the questions the way they did. And I think that is kind of the abusive side of law enforcement. And we see that in a lot of cases, especially among people who just lack the sophistication about how the process works, where the cops get them in there and they say things to them and they get, you know, as you said, they'll, like, you know, say, you know, are you thirsty? Like, well, if you just tell us what we want, we can get you a drink. You know, it's also important to realize that, you know, it's a lie. It's a felony offense to lie to an FBI agent. You know, so if he asks you, have you ever been to Pakistan, and you say no, and you really have, potentially you could be prosecuted. At the same time, it's not a felony offense, or it's not an offense at all for an FBI agent to lie to you. So the FBI agent could say, hey, your partner over there in the other room, he said you did it. It's time for you to confess, right? That may have not happened, but often that's what's used in interrogations. And so the FBI and most law enforcement has this obscene advantage in these kind of settings where, you know, I think people who are unsophisticated ultimately end up saying things that that bury them. And that was definitely the case in Hamid Hayat's prosecution where, you know, the single piece of evidence they really had was his confession. And, you know, I think in a lot of cases, juries are willing to believe confessions. I think they're willing, they're not as skeptical as I think they should be. And I think there's a feeling among juries that, you know, hey, these FBI guys, like they're the white hats, they're the good guys, you know, they're working on our side and for, you know, for the side of justice. And, you know, that isn't always the case. And it certainly wasn't the case in Hyatt's prosecution.
Hey guys, Scott here. I've got some books you should read. The War State by Mike Swanson, a great history of the early Cold War. No Dev, No Ops, No IT by Hussein Badakhshani. How to Run Your Computer Business Like a Good Libertarian. Oh yeah, and don't forget Fool's Errand, Time to End the War in Afghanistan by me. Hey y'all, here's the thing. Donate $100 to the Scott Horton Show and you can get a QR code commodity disc as my gift to you. It's a 1 ounce silver disc with a QR code on the back. You take a picture of it with your phone, and it gives you the instant spot price and lets you know what that silver, that ounce of silver is worth on the market in Federal Reserve notes in real time. It's the future of currency in the past too. CommodityDiscs.com or just go to ScottHorton.org/donate. Hey guys, you know, you probably need a new website. A lot of people do. What you need to do then is go to ExpandDesigns.com. The great Harley Abbott and his team over at ExpandDesigns.com, they'll hook you up with a great new website for 2019. And in fact, what you really should do is type in ExpandDesigns.com/Scott, and you'll save $500. Well, and so this is the thing about it too, and this is one that's always really stood out among all of the bogus prosecutions, and there's been so many of them. And there's a lot that I can't just think of off the top of my head, but there's a solid dozen or more that I can. But in this one, he actually was never really entrapped into doing anything. He didn't accidentally put his fingerprints on some guns. He didn't saw off any barrels. He didn't attempt to detonate any fake explosives. He never really did anything other than the way I remember it. There was a phone call where the informant, and I want to talk more about the informant in a minute, or ask you more about the informant in a minute, but the informant essentially just browbeat him on the phone that, like, come on, say you love Osama. You love me, don't you? You promise we're friends, and you have to say, just say you love Osama. And then this confession, essentially, that said that he had been to a camp. But other than that, that was it, right? Material support based on that, 25 years, or what am I missing?
Yeah, that's pretty much the case. You know, I mean, as you know well, a lot of these terrorism sting operations ultimately bring people to the point where they have access to a fake bomb that, of course, the FBI provided, and the case ends when they try to detonate that bomb. And so the FBI has a very clear, you know, this is what he did, and this is why we're prosecuting him. In Hamid Hayat's case, you know, the FBI really didn't have any proof that he attended a terrorist training camp, other than the conversations he had with the informant, where he was basically saying he was going to do that, and the conversations the interrogation and confession that he gave to the FBI. And the informant, you know, was this guy who was making tons of money from the FBI and really had questions about, you know, there were clear questions about his credibility. You know, the reason the FBI came to enroll him as an informant was that they had gotten a tip that, you know, post 9/11, he was living in Oregon, and there were questions about, like, whether he was involved in, you know, some sort of terrorism. And they looked in that claim, and it turned out he wasn't the guy they were looking for. But then when the FBI was there, he was like, hey, you know, I have some information about Ayman al-Zawahiri, the al-Qaeda number two, or Osama bin Laden's deputy. And so the FBI became very interested. He gave them what information he had, and it turned out it was bogus. You know, the prosecutors later claimed it was just a innocent case of mistaken identity. You know, a more skeptical version of that might be that he was just feeding them information in the hopes of getting some money. But it worked because then the FBI in the post 9/11 rush to sign up informants brings him on board. He ends up going to Lodi and ends up getting involved in a relationship or friendship with Hamid and his father. And over the course of months, you know, like as is common in these cases, the target of the investigation ends up kind of having this kind of little brother relationship with the informant. And the informant in Hamid's case got him on the phone when he was in Pakistan. It was basically like, you're going, right? Like, you know, you support Osama bin Laden. Will you're going to the training camp. And on the phone, you know, Hamid is like, yeah, I'm going. And it turns out he was just saying that, you know, just to kind of satisfy what the informant was wanting him to say with no real intention of going. And so then ultimately when he returns to the United States, the FBI is working from this information that he had given the informant that he planned to go, and then they just, you know, interrogate him and get this confession. Well, it turns out we can say definitively nearly 15 years later that, you know, what he was telling the informant was just crap. He was just telling the informant what he thought the informant wanted to hear. And then ultimately the confession he makes is bogus, that he was just willing to tell the FBI anything to get out of that room. And, you know, that's what the case was based on. And so, you know, in the spectrum of post 9/11 terrorism cases, you know, this was on the very far side of egregious because, you know, at least in these entrapment cases, you can point to the fact that the guy did do this, right? He did have this fake bomb and he tried to detonate. In Hamid Hayat's case, you know, the government really couldn't even prove that he attended this camp. And then, you know, when they tried to present to the jury, you know, they ultimately presented pictures of this camp that internally, it turns out, you know, there was even questions of whether that was the real camp, but that's not something they disclosed to the jury at the time.
Mm-hmm. Now, refresh my memory, his grandfather's house in Pakistan, that was in Karachi? Do you remember?
No, I don't remember. I believe it was just outside Karachi because it was a very populated area. I'd have to look up the city, unfortunately, which I don't have in front of me. But one of the issues that came up in kind of the questions of the case was that it was this really urban area. And, you know, when he was asked to describe where one of the terrorist training camps was, he described it as being in this like forested encampment in the city, which is just ridiculous because there was no way this kind of urban jungle would accommodate something like that. And so, you know, there were clear signs that the FBI should have been like, what is this guy talking about? Like, how can there be a camp in this more urban area? And you know, yet like there was this kind of suspension of disbelief among the FBI, you know, whether it's, you know, they wanted to prosecute this guy and put him in jail, or they just really were kind of true believers that they just thought like, yeah, this guy's definitely involved in terrorism.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's been a few years now. I'm pretty sure you linked to this LA Times story in your piece. Maybe I just Googled it up, but there was a LA Times story all about this a few years back, that I guess centered around a former FBI agent who himself saw the confession video and said, this is just a travesty, and joined the fight on the side of the lawyers here. But nowadays you can't see the video anymore. But when the LA Times first published that story, they had the video from the confession. I don't know the whole thing, but clips of it anyway. And so I didn't get a chance to check the Netflix thing to see whether they included this stuff or not. And so I am just going essentially by memory, but I had kind of retold the story a couple of times, so I remember it pretty well, that, you know, part of it was the FBI agent essentially just leading the kid to say, oh, your grandfather's house, it's in Karachi, huh? Which is essentially like the most innocent place you could be in Pakistan, right? Right. Are you sure it wasn't in Islamabad? Yeah, sure, it's in Islamabad. I don't know. Yeah, my grandfather's house, it's in Islamabad. And then all of a sudden, a couple of clicks later, and now it's in Kandahar, right? It's outside of Kandahar City in the Kandahar province in Afghanistan, right, with Taliban country, you know? Oh, yeah, sure. Yeah, it's in Kandahar, if you say so. That's where I was training with Al-Qaeda in Kandahar, yeah. And then, and this is the part where people are going to think I'm lying, but the point is that this is the FBI who came up with this stuff. He says that the training camp is in the basement. That's how they hide it, is they have an Al-Qaeda training camp in his grandfather's basement. And then, so the cop says to him, and what do they do down there? And he holds his hands like he's pantomiming holding a stick, right? Like, if you were going to finish his sentence for him, you might suggest, Trevor, that, oh, they, what, like, practice stick fighting or something like that? But the FBI agent says, pole vaulting? They're practicing pole vaulting? And the kid says, yeah, that's right. Al-Qaeda terrorists are practicing pole vaulting in my grandfather's basement in Kandahar. Take me away. Essentially.
Right.
And the FBI agent is like, oh, yeah, you're going to the penitentiary now, buddy. And, you know, I don't know what to think of that. I'm supposed to believe that the FBI agent believed that? That this is... I thought you had to have a non-fluoridated IQ of at least 100 and something to be an FBI agent. No, I mean, this is complete nonsense. And it was so transparent and ridiculous to sit there and watch that.
Yeah, no, I agree. I mean, I think the agent you're talking about is a former FBI agent named James Wedick. And he was brought in fairly early, I think, by the defense lawyers after the conviction to look at the confession tape. And, you know, he had been a supervisory agent. He'd worked for the FBI for more than 20 years. And his first instinct was yeah, this confession is bogus, that he'd clearly been coerced. He'd clearly been asked leading questions. And so it was highly problematic. And you're right. I mean, you know, what logical FBI agent would really think that a bunch of Al-Qaeda terrorists are training underground, you know, using pole vaults, right? It makes absolutely no sense.
And in the text, they do mention pole vaulting in the text of that LA Times article. So people can find that, even if you can't see the video of that.
Yeah, I mean, and that's part of what's interesting about his confession is that, like, it really is all over the place because, you know, as the FBI is giving him cues of what they're interested in, he's just kind of like following along, right? I mean, I included a part of the interrogation in the story where, you know, they ask him, like, you know, it's 3 a.m., he's saying his head is hurting, and they're like, well, we really want you to know, like, we need to know what they told you to target, what are you going to attack, right? Like, so he's basically being told, like, he has to provide them something, and so he's like, they told me to go attack buildings, and they're like, well, what kind of buildings? And his response is, like, big buildings. And other things like that. And he's like, what else? Like, and he says, like, stores. And like, what kind of stores? Like, food stores, right? He's just like kind of like going with whatever they're saying, just adding the most simple adjective to everything that they want. So it did seem pretty clear that this guy was just telling them, you know, whatever they wanted. But scary enough, like, you know, it resulted in a conviction, right? A jury convicted this guy and he got, you know, sentenced to 24 years in prison originally.
Man, it's something else. All right, so let's go back to the dad's confession a little bit. This is, I know, much less about this part of the story here, but you mentioned before, and it's in the article, about how they had told him, listen, if you did go and see your son at this camp, that's essentially like if you were just visiting him at college. In other words, they were leading him to believe that if you agree to this narrative, that this doesn't implicate you in any crimes. We would consider this to be innocent behavior, but we're just trying to get confirmation from you of what we know of this story. But I wonder whether there was a carrot or stick kind of thing there. Were they threatening his son with a worse charge or maybe promising some leniency for the son if the father would just go along with this part of the narrative? Or do you know?
So how they led Umar was that they basically... The claim they told Umar was like, look, your son, you know, is in this other room and he confessed to attending this training camp. And, you know, we don't think this is a big deal because, and I'm summarizing their words, you know, in Pakistan, it's part of your culture. You go to these training camps and, you know, I'm sure the parents go and visit the kids at these training camps. And, you know, really, it's not a big deal. It'd be like, you know, if you went to visit him, it would be like, you know, someone here visiting their kid at college to check out the campus. And they really just minimized to Umar the significance of what had happened. And, you know, we're basically framed that, like, you know, we think maybe something happened here, but if you can explain it, we can make this all go away. And so at first, Umar, you know, said he didn't attend the camp. He didn't know anything about the camp. And then finally he ends up telling them what they want. And, what he says to them is that, you know, he, you know, there was this large camp and there were these like 1,000 fighters and he used the term like wore masks like Ninja Turtles and really described this like over the top setting for this camp. And you know, a few days later he recanted and said I didn't, you know, I made all of this up because that's what the FBI wanted me to say. And, you know, ironically, the FBI ultimately, you know, acknowledged through the Department of Justice that they realized, they agreed he made it all up, because they charged him with making false statements to the FBI, and he ended up pleading guilty, and I think he served a year or two in prison as a result. And
those were the false statements, was him agreeing to their narrative.
Exactly, exactly. And again, this is like another good cautionary tale for like dealing with the FBI, right? Like, again, they can lie to you, but if you lie to them, you know, you're facing a possible felony charge. And so they browbeat him into saying, like, hey, you attended this training camp, or I'm sorry, you visited this training camp. And then when he's finally like, okay, I visited it, and here's this, like, you know, description of it that I'm just going to make up for you, they charge him with a felony of lying to the FBI, because, in fact, he did lie to the FBI. I mean, under the law, he was guilty. He did lie. But, you know, in a way that the FBI kind of, like, coerced from him. And again, like I mentioned earlier, like, you know, it really doesn't benefit any defendant, whether you're innocent or guilty, to talk to the FBI for this exact reason. You know, had Umar just said, I have nothing to say to you guys, call me a lawyer, they wouldn't have had any case against him, right? I mean, he was entirely prosecutable because he lied during an interrogation.
And charging him with the false confession that they forced him into. I mean, that's like Sandra Bland pulls over for the cop, and then he pulls her over for not using her turn signal when she pulled over for him. What the hell?
Right. But that's what the FBI does. I mean, lying to the FBI is among the more commonly filed charges. You know, you saw this kind of commonly in the Mueller prosecutions, right? Like almost everybody charged was charged with, you know, charges, including lying to the FBI. And it's a way of just kind of either, you know, kind of like throwing one more charge at someone, or, you know, in a case like Umar or someone else, they're not able to charge with anything else. And so they'll charge based on that, perhaps with the hope that, you know, they'll cut a deal and say, okay, I don't want to go to jail, but I'll give you information on such and such. In other cases, it's just pure, in my view, like retribution. You know, the FBI's pissed this guy, you know, pulled their chain with this kind of ridiculous description of a terrorism training site and kind of embarrassed them. And so they're like, screw you, man, we're going to file lines to the FBI charges. Yeah. I mean, I don't think, you know, it might be unfair to kind of say it so bluntly, but that's how I kind of view some of these prosecutions sometimes.
Yeah, absolutely. Of course. That's exactly how they are. And this is the problem, right? Is like you're talking about, hey, man, you just shouldn't talk to the cops. Get a lawyer and let your lawyer handle it. That's his job, kind of a thing. It's because you have this weird cross between them being human beings, like literally standing there in clothes and everything, but at the same time, they're not really humans. They are agents of the state. And so that means that your interactions with them are an entirely different set of rules for anyone else. So I saw a defense attorney one time say that, look, for example, whenever you're talking with anyone else, you try to always give as much credence to what they're saying as you can, just being polite. That's straight out of Dale Carnegie, How to Win Friends and Influence People. You know, so somebody says to you, well, did you ever think about doing this or doing that? You go, well, I don't know, I might have, you know, or so, you know, you go ahead, you try to be agreeable. But, you know, that's a reason why you should not talk to cops, because you're going to fall into the habit of being a decent and kind person. But in fact, what you're doing is you're giving them rope to hang yourself with, whether you actually did anything or not. And it turns out they don't really care if you did anything or not. They have their own incentives for putting you in prison. They have nothing to do with justice whatsoever. This isn't the Perry Mason show.
Yeah, law enforcement in many ways is a hammer looking for a nail, right? And so, you know, if you kind of are interviewed by the FBI or other law enforcement agents for any reason, and, you know, if you got in trouble, you know, whether it was drugs or you've got like mental illness issues or maybe you weren't in trouble at all, you haven't done anything, you know, the FBI is not looking there to help you, right? They're not like, if you've got drug problems, they're not looking to help you get straight. If you've got, you know, kind of domestic violence issues and there's problems at home, they're not there to sort that out, right? They are there to figure out if you committed a crime, and if you did, they're going to arrest you, right? They're not a social services agency. And so the idea that, like, you should provide them with any information, you know, is incredibly risky, because the only purpose for that information is to use it against you. And so there's absolutely no upside, whatever, to talk to law enforcement at all. And I think, you know, I think that's something Americans really don't know enough about and aren't familiar with enough with. You know, it's kind of like, you know, when you talk to law enforcement, you say you don't want to, you know, they talk, they're like, well, what are you hiding? It's like, well, you have every right not to incriminate yourself and provide information, you know. And like, I don't do drugs, for example, and I don't drive around with drugs in my car. But if a law enforcement agent stopped me for a traffic issue and was like, hey, can we search your car? I have nothing to hide, but I'm not going to let them do it, right? You need probable cause. Like, you can't just, like, search my car. And, you know, and I think that's, you know, I think that's, like, you know, if anything, Hamid Hayat's case is a really kind of extreme example of how this can go bad for you if you end up volunteering information to federal law enforcement or any law enforcement agency, because ultimately they built a case, you know, almost entirely on what he told them.
Yeah. And hey, you know what? Hypothetical example, there's some very serious crime where innocent lives are at risk and you have information that they really do need to know. It's so bad that it's better to be a rat than not even. And I don't mean turning in your friends on a drug charge or something, but I mean something really bad is going to happen. Call a lawyer and have the lawyer call them. You still don't need to talk to them. That's what Absolutely. Lawyers are.
Yeah, yeah. And, you know, if you do want to report a crime, like you say, like, hey, I just saw three guys run into a bank with a bunch of guns, you know, call 911 and just leave it at that. But, you know, examples where, like, if the cops come to you and ask you questions about things you've done, I mean, generally that's not a good place for anyone to be. You know, and as I said, Hyatt's case is a great example of how wrong that can go. You know, I mean, it's one thing to be cooperative with law enforcement and reporting criminal activity that's maybe happening in your neighborhood. It's another to be cooperative with them when they're clearly investigating you. And if they're asking you questions about what you did and where you've been, I mean, make no mistake, they're investigating you.
Yeah. All right. Now, back to the specifics of this case again here real quick. A couple of important points here, I think. First of all, the informant here just infiltrated this family, this father and son. There was no group, right? There was no politics. He just found a father and son and made himself kind of, and this happens, people are familiar with this, like Fonzie or whatever, right? Like the adopted son. He calls the dad, dad. And then he treats the son like it's, you know, like he's big brothers and big sisters of America or whatever, and kind of insinuates himself into, I mean, some group, a father and son, that's it. He makes himself part of their family just to put words in this child's mouth. Well, I guess he wasn't a child. He was like 21 at the time, right? To put words in this young man's mouth.
Right, right. Yeah, he was young. He was a fairly sheltered guy. They lived in Lodi, which is this agricultural community that has a very large Pakistani population. And, you know, the informant, Samir Khan, you know, basically became part of that family over a course of months. And that's not unusual in a lot of these terrorism prosecutions where the informant will kind of establish this really close and almost intimate relationship with the target of the investigation. And, you know, the reason for that in kind of the most cynical sense is that the FBI is paying this guy a lot of money to find terrorists. And so, you know, by getting to know these people, he's able to kind of manipulate them into saying things that he needs them to say in order to kind of bring it to the FBI. And that's what happened in this case. And so, you know, as Hamid Hayat goes to Pakistan, and I believe the initial purpose of the trip was to try to find a potential bride through an arranged marriage situation in Pakistan. And the informant stays back in the United States with his father, you know, and even then he's talking to his father and he's talking to Hamid Hayat on the phone and really trying to get him to say, you know, that he wants to attend this camp and, you know, he's interested in Al-Qaeda. All of these ideas are ultimately coming from the informant, which in turn is ultimately coming from the FBI.
And as you said, you know, the kid is on the phone. He's essentially just BSing the informant just to get him to leave him alone. Yeah, 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 Al-Qaeda. Yeah, 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 I promise I'll go to the camp. When he had no intention of doing so. And as you say, there's sworn testimony he was instead playing video games.
Right, right. And I think, you know, I mean, really what this is something as simple as, like, you know, Hamid was a fairly immature guy. You know, if you think back to your schoolyard days and you wanted to fit into a group and, you know, you maybe mimicked the things that those kids in the other group did and said, you know, that was really what was happening with Hamid and the informant. Like, Hamid was just, like, you know, saying the things that the informant, you know, initially brought up and, you know, either to kind of fit in because he didn't have a lot of friends, he wasn't particularly social, or, you know, just to kind of make it go away. Like, hey, man, I'm sick of you bothering me about this issue. Like, yeah, I'll go. And that's ultimately how it came off. But, you know, if you're being generous to the FBI, the generous view would be that they really suspected this guy was involved in something pretty dangerous. And so when he says this, it confirms that belief. You know, if you're being, you know, more cynical about what the FBI was doing, it's that they were kind of skeptical, but hey, they've got a prosecutable case because the guy said this. And it really wasn't a case of like, you know, is this guy really, you know, involved in terrorism? Because he just, you know, the evidence shows he just clearly wasn't. Mm-hmm. And again, I mean, it would be one thing, it would be bad enough as a case that stands on its own. But, you know, keep in mind that Hamid Hayat is one of more than 800 people who have been caught up in these post 9/11 terrorism investigations. And indeed, there have been some that have been dangerous and some that may have posed a threat, but a vast majority were not involved in terrorism, did not have connections to terrorists. It was really made possible through the actions of undercover informants or undercover agents. And, you know, so, you know, what we've done is we've, you know, really busted a lot of people that really shouldn't have been busted. And I think what this has also done, you know, to kind of bring it forward into the moment we are now, you know, we've had all of these largely Muslims convicted and in cases that are very well publicized nationally in these terrorism cases. And, you know, I think we've begun to kind of view this as like, you know, culturally it became like, oh, terrorism is a Muslim thing, because ultimately all of these cases inflated the perception in the United States that, you know, terrorism from Islamists is incredibly dangerous and prevalent, even though the vast majority of these cases were largely manufactured by the government. Yeah. And so by the time we get to 2016 and Donald Trump is running for president of the United States, you know, he can say things like, you know, we should shut down immigration from, you know, Muslim countries until we can figure out what the hell is going on, right? Well, like, what he's referring to are all these, like, terrorism prosecutions that have kind of been in the ether for 15 right. years. And I think, you know, if you're really kind of looking at the long narrative of this, I mean, you can point to the FBI in these cases as kind of setting the mood for the current kind of Islamophobia yeah. that we're now in.
Agree. Absolutely. And, you know, I mean, the thing of it, too, is I remember probably even in our earlier interviews, you know, probably going back to the Bush years, where we talked about how, certainly on my show, we talked about this in different contexts, that, you know, they have to fake all the terrorists because Al-Qaeda was only 400 or 500 guys. So they have to come up with all these bogus cases. But then they use the September 11th attack to launch all these other wars. And so it was easy to predict that there will be real blowback, real backdraft, even when, you know, it's short-term consequences blowing up right in your face. When you have veterans of America's jihad in Syria blowing up targets in Europe, or you have, you know, the Orlando attack and Zazi and a couple of the others have been, I guess, let's see, in my book, I list about, I guess, a half dozen, 8 or 10 real terrorists, not entrapped by the FBI, but real bad guys. But they all started, when did they start? In the Obama years, right? It was Fort Hood was the first major one. It took years for Bush to really provoke any real ones. And in the meantime, Bob Mueller was happy to entrap hundreds of people, as you say here, and these fake ones. And now they do both. But, you know, like in the case, oh, that was you that taught me this. In the case of the Boston attack, when the Russians had said, you need to look out for these brothers, they said, yeah, we're busy entrapping some stupid kid on the other side of town.
Right,
to pay
right.
attention to the real one going on right there, which is another one we warned about. I know that you and I warned about back in history that as these cops are all chasing their tails on these bogus entrapment cases, you're going to have real guys slipping through the cracks, which is then exactly what happens.
Yeah, you know, I mean, the FBI is very good at finding these, like, you know, knuckleheads who don't have connections to international terrorists, don't have any weapons, and, you know, getting them wrapped up in cases and busting them. But the people like Omar Mateen and the Orlando attacker and others, you know, these were people that, you know, really fell through the FBI's dragnet, and they weren't as good at finding these people. And I think you're right as well. I mean, in addition to these fake cases kind of setting the stage for you know, Islamophobia we have now, there's also this really strange kind of narrative and question that we have in this country about terrorism or Islamist terrorism, which is always this kind of like, I don't understand why they're attacking us. Why are they doing this, right? How do we stop? And if you look, I mean, they actually tell you, right? Like, as an example, there was a guy affiliated with ISIS or claiming allegiance to ISIS who tried to bomb the bus terminal in New York City. Fortunately, his suicide bomb did not go off. And, you know, he told police that, you know, the reason he did this was he saw his neighbor's wedding in Pakistan, you know, get blown up from a drone, right? And he's like, I'm going to, like, avenge that. And so I think one of the things that we don't really think about is that there is this blowback, right?
Wait, I'm sorry, you're referring there to the Times Square attack of 2010?
This was a couple of years ago, I think in 2016 or 17.
Oh, okay.
There was a failed bombing attempt at the Port Authority bus terminal in New York. A guy claiming affiliation with ISIS strapped a bomb to himself and tried to blow it up, but it didn't blow up. Hmm. I think it sparked a little bit. He caused some burning to his chest, but ultimately he survived. And he had told the police that, you know, the reason he did this was, you know, because of this drone attack of this wedding. And, you know, it's instructive in this sense that, like, you know, part of, you know, we are inspiring terrorism, right? And you know, after the Iraq War, you know, and our kind of general policies in the Middle East, you know, some of what we're seeing is a reaction, right? And there was a story recently about how, you know, when Tony Blair was being pushed to support the Iraq War, you know, his national security advisors had written a memo that basically said, you know, if you do this, if we go into Iraq, we're going to destabilize that region, and what we're going to ultimately see is attacks in Europe, you know, from, you know, people, you know, coming out of that war. And that's exactly what we've seen, right? And so I think, you know, this is also kind of part of the narrative on terrorism, too, is I think, you know, it's really silly to be having this conversation of, like, well, why do they do this? And, you know, there are certainly people who attack for, you know, just overly ideological or homicidal reasons. But, you know, in some of these cases, they are attacking in response to our own policies, whether that's airstrikes in the Middle East or drone attacks. And, you know, this is their way of kind of settling that score.
Exactly. I mean, that's the thing, right, is, you know, you can accuse them of war crimes if they're attacking civilian targets. That doesn't make their actions legitimate in any way. It just any more than when our side attacks civilian targets or helps the Saudis attack civilian targets or whatever the case is. But it's just to recognize the reality that the reason that they're doing this is because they're in a war. They're on the other side of one. But as you say, and same thing with virtually all of these guys, Mateen or the Tsarnaev brothers or any of these people, going back to the first World Trade Center bombing, they always say exactly what their motive is. And their motive is always American foreign policy.
Right. Right. So, yeah. And I think, you know, so if we're going to have a conversation about what causes terrorism, you know, I think part of that conversation that we've never had is, like, what is our role in that, right? How have our unjust wars and how have our bombings, you know, there's this perception, I think, in the culture that the way the U.S. bombs is, like, we have these precision bombs and we only kill the targets, right? And, like, that's not the case at all, right? I mean, air wars more recently documented how, you know, in the attempt to, you know, destroy ISIS in Syria, you know, we were carpet bombing lots of Eastern Syria, and we were killing civilians, right? And so this is, you know, we may, you know, so the irony in all of this, of course, is that maybe we finally brought ISIS to its knees in Syria, but, you know, what other extremism and terrorism are we going to inspire in the future by those sorts of actions, by carpet bombing towns and cities? And, you know, I think these are the kind of harder conversations to have about the roots of terrorism. And
well, back to the entrapments, you know, there's, I don't think, a single case of these entrapments where the rat didn't say to the mark, don't you hate American foreign policy? Look
right.
at what they're
right.
doing, right? So this isn't lost on the FBI. The FBI doesn't have their informants tell these people, don't you hate freedom? Don't you hate it that blonde girls in miniskirts can vote in primary elections and blah, blah, blah? No. Don't you hate rated R movies? No, that's not it. It's killing people. That's what the FBI informants use to manipulate their marks in these fake cases over and over again. No exceptions, I don't think. You tell me if you know of any, and you wrote the book on it.
No, you're absolutely right. You know, I mean, it's funny, you often hear, like, politicians will say about terrorists, like, you know, they hate our freedom, right? That's why they do this. And that's not why they do this. And you're right, even in these terrorism sting cases where the FBI is planting the idea, you know, the inspiration that they work with is this idea of, you know, American foreign policy in the Middle East, whether it's army bases in Saudi Arabia near Mecca and Medina, or whether it's bomb strikes in you know, in Iraq, in other places in the Middle East, or drone attacks. And that's really what they're working with, is this idea that, you know, the United States is killing with impunity in the Muslim world. And, you know, they're, what they want to do is offer a way of striking back on that. And, you know, obviously, you know, I don't think, you know, it's right at all that, you know, these terrorists are trying to do the things they're doing. But I do think it's wrong that we're not having a more honest conversation about America's role in inspiring those types of that type of violence.
Absolutely. All right. Now, one more subject before I let you go here. And that is, you know, you mentioned about the FBI agents. If you want to be charitable, you can say, look, they were scared and then they had all this confirmation bias. Pole vaulting. I knew it. Whatever, you know, or maybe they really were just being that cynical and they don't care. Hey, let the jury decide and what have you, this and that. But here's the unforgivable part, is they told the local news and, of course, the national news, too. But they told the people of Lodi, California, that we found a terrorist Al-Qaeda sleeper cell embedded in the Pakistani community in your sleepy little town. And this was a community that had lived there for, I guess, since the 1980s. Something like that, for a while, and had had no problems and got along, were well integrated into the society and everything. And all of a sudden, in the most apocalyptic terms, our supposed security force, here are public servants to protect us and all this stuff, came and drove this giant wedge between the Pakistani-American population of that town and everybody else. And, you know, who knows what kind of collateral damage came from that, but I bet it's far worse than we know.
For sure. So, I mean, there's a couple of things to unpack there. I mean, one is that, you know, what we've seen since 9/11 is the FBI and the Justice Department generally really overplay these cases. And, you know, the reason I argue that they do is that, you know, since post 9/11, the FBI is an organization that is not only a law enforcement agency, but also an intelligence and counterterrorism agency, but they measure their success, they justify their budget through the old school metric of law enforcement, which is arrests made, right? And so it becomes part of their culture to take in large budgets for counterterrorism and counterintelligence, and then announce with great fanfare these cases. And in many cases, that means overstating or overblowing the case. And at the same time, what that ultimately does by kind of making a big deal about these cases as being terrorism cases when the links for terrorism are at times tenuous or even non-existent, is it creates, you know, a lot of suspicion between the targeted communities, mostly Muslim, and the other communities where they think, well, like, you know, are there terrorists among us? And I think when the average American, you know, reads the news or watches the news and they hear about a terrorism bust in their community involving Muslims, you know, their first suspicion, you know, they're not staying up on the news as you and I are and researching this. I mean, they're just like, you know, Americans trying to get through their day, right? You can't blame them. And I think, you know, as a result, their immediate reaction is like, oh, there must be danger among this Muslim community. And I think we've seen that drive wedges in communities around the country. And again, I think it's what feeds into a lot of the Trump policies now and fed into his own election campaign, which is this idea that, you know, this group is very dangerous and we need to do something about it, whether it's through immigration or even more draconian policies. And I, you know, I think that's the kind of terrible situation we're in now where, you know, pre 9/11, Muslim communities in the United States were very well integrated into communities. They were among the most affluent of immigrant communities in the United States. And so it's ironic that post 9/11, we then kind of portrayed them largely as the boogeyman. And, you know, that isn't to say that Islamist terrorism isn't real, right? Like, it obviously is. We talked about the Orlando shooting and others. You know, there have been attacks, but, you know, there have not been those on the level that, you know, we see portrayed by the FBI. And Lodi is an example of that, right? You had this very well-integrated Pakistani-American community in Northern California. There was no record of any substantial problems with that community. And suddenly, post 9/11, you've got this really problematic case. And the FBI is touting like, hey, we found this sleeper cell. And, you know, ultimately, what does that do for the reputation of that community in California? It largely impugns it. And I think that's something that, you know, Muslim communities around the country are struggling with now is like, you know, how do we kind of get past the reputational damage that these kind of cases and policies have reaped on us in our own communities? And I think that's why more and more you see, you know, organizations like CARE and others like trying to hold you know, kind of meet and greets and, you know, dialogue to kind of show that, like, look, this, we're just like you, here we are, you know, we've been rather vilified and we're trying to figure out, you know, how we go back to, you know, the time before we were vilified. And, you know, I think now, you know, we're also seeing the vilification of other groups now in different ways, right? Like Hispanic immigrants, you know, as being sources of economic problems or crime as the current administration is portraying them. And so, you know, it's troubling to see, you know, kind of the expansion of this policies in different ways toward different groups.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that, of course, is all a lot of blowback from America's drug wars in Mexico and coup d'etats and support for all sorts of right-wing juntas and policies in Latin America and all that. Otherwise, people of Honduras probably want to live in their hometown where they're from, like everybody else. They're fleeing something, and it's the policies of the last government, of course. One last thing here, which is simply that it goes without saying always, but I think it's worth saying. We all know there's no chance that there will be accountability for any of the cops, the prosecutors, the judges, the jurors, the prison officials, and all the people involved in conspiring to deprive this innocent man of his liberty for the last 15 years here. Hey, we got qualified immunity. Mistakes happen. Who cares? It's not at our expense. It never will be, is the slogan of the federal prosecutor. And everybody knows it to such a degree that it's essentially unthinkable for me to bring up the idea of accountability for these people who did the wrong thing, whether deliberately or not, is preposterous. It makes me the kook for even saying that it's something that we ought to consider as a thing that should be. So I'm happy to play that role.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think you're absolutely right. I mean, even if you look at Deborah Barnes, the magistrate judge's recommendation to have Hamid Hayat's case overturned, she went out of her way not to directly criticize the government's behavior, right? She pointed out the problems with the case, but did not take on the government. And that's fairly common among the judiciary, unfortunately, where I don't think you see the courage to bring the government to task on some of these issues, or take the government to task on some of these issues. And, you know, so the prosecutor who prosecuted this case, his career won't be affected. The FBI agents who coerced those confessions, their career won't be affected. And I think that's part of the problem that these abuses continue, is that there is no accountability. And then separate from the judiciary, the other area where the FBI could be held accountable is Congress. And we all know how that's going, right? Like, the Congress isn't, you know, willing to really question the FBI about much of anything, and unless it involves the Mueller investigation. And so there's all sorts of problems that you see in the FBI and an unwillingness to really address them, either in the judiciary or in the Congress.
Yeah. Will Grigg used to joke about, there was a Tom Clancy movie with Harrison Ford, you know, one of those from the 1990s, where the movie ends with Harrison Ford takes a stack of documents and marches up Capitol Hill. And then, like, the sun sets and the credits roll, and you know that that's the point when accountability kicked in, or something.
Right.
Just
right.
How alien that is to our way of life. That's not at all how things are around here, but it makes for a fun kind of a closer to a movie. Hour and a half is up, you know? Anyway.
Yeah, it's how it works in Hollywood, but not in real life.
Yeah. All right, listen, I can't tell you how much I appreciate all of your great work. Your great book, The Terror Factory, which started out life as an article for Mother Jones Magazine way back before David Corn invented Russiagate. There was something interesting published in that thing. And then there's The Terror Factory, the great book, and all of your great writing at TheIntercept.com, including this one, Reporters Questioned His Terror Prosecution. Now he's free. Thank you again, Trevor.
Great. Thanks so much, Scott. I appreciate being on.
All right, y'all. Thanks. Find me at libertarianinstitute.org, at scotthorton.org, antiwar.com, and reddit.com/Scott Horton Show. Oh, yeah. And read my book, Fool's Errand, Timed and the War in Afghanistan, at foolserrand.us.